Hey, everybody, and welcome to this episode of Movie Mentors. I'm your host, Jeremy Boros, and today we're speaking with the Oscar-nominated editor, Mark Goldblatt. Since the mid-70s, Mark has been one of Hollywood's top cinema editors, cutting iconic films like Terminator and True Lies, cult classics like Showgirls and Piranha, and modern-day blockbusters like Bad Boys 2 and Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Nominated for an Oscar for editing Terminator 2, Mark is also a passionate cinephile and repeat governor of the editing branch of the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences. Needless to say, this guy knows movies. He lives and breathes the cinema. So it was particularly special to hear his insights after a lifetime in motion pictures. So please, sit back and enjoy this very special conversation with your mentor, Mark Goldblatt.
Top of the morning to you.
Good morning.
Good morning. How you doing?
I'm good. It's 2 p.m. You're just waking up, right?
Right. Sunrise.
I love that about you, because you screen movies all the way into the wee hours of the morning almost every night.
Well, I try, because that's the best time to watch a movie, because it's real quiet and I can really get into it. No distractions.
Yeah.
No emergency phone calls.
No children, dogs, nagging wives. You're just on your own with the cinema.
Cinema and me.
Perfect. Mark, I want to start with a very simple question.
Okay.
Which is, what makes a great editor?
I don't know.
Well, goodbye, everyone. Thank you for tuning in.
That was quick. No. Editing. What is editing? Editing is taking a lot of fragments of different things and putting them together and juxtaposing them and telling a story. The editor is responsible for synthesizing all the moving parts, the intention, the realization of the screenplay, the actual performances that are given, the camera moves. Every camera move is an ethical decision. It relates to performance. It relates to story clarity, to the audience, to emotion. Emotion is key. We're trying to tap into the emotions of the audience. The audience is reacting. The audience is engaged in the storyline. The audience identifies with the characters. This is drama. This is the interrelationship of storytelling in the cinema.
So would you say that editing is less an intellectual manipulation exercise and more a spiritual or emotional experience?
It's a combination of all of those things. The intellect cannot be denied. There's thought processes. There's logic. We try to assume logic. Sometimes an editor thinks that you have to be logical. Well, first let's have a wide shot so we know where we are. Where are we? We're in the city. It's a big city. There's a lot of houses in the city. We're in a wide shot. But we zero in on one house. And now we go into the family that lives in that house. And now we have the universe of the family. And it's more of a microcosm and a macrocosm. But remember, we're telling stories and we're trying to communicate beyond just what we say in the text, what we see in the text, what we hear in the film. Audio, visual, components, storytelling, building blocks of story, emotion. When you're working on a film, you have to be open. It's a storyteller, the director, has a consciousness, and is telling a story from a particular point of view. We need to tap into that storytelling process. We need to tap into the intentions of the director. But the intentions of the director may be more than the director can even enumerate. Because he is also, or she, is dealing from the subconscious and the unconscious. And all the creative decisions that you make come from the conscious and the unconscious at the same time.
Yeah.
So you have an intention, you have a task, you also have to step back and experience everything that's been collected to the making of a movie or a production and own it and ride with it. Keeping your eye on the story. I don't know if this is too airy-fairy.
No, it's actually a perfect segue into a little bit of your history, which is that you majored in philosophy, right, mm-hmm. before you studied film?
I did, because I thought philosophy was very interesting. I was always thinking about reality. What's real? What's not? Mm-hmm. Do I have free will or is it determined? You know, the ancient questions that we all ask.
Take us back. Where did you grow up? What movies were you watching as a kid growing up?
I was born in Brooklyn and grew up in Brooklyn, New York. I got into watching TV, I guess, came before anything else. I mean, I read books as well at an early age. And I watched Westerns, Gene Autry, Roy Rogers, Johnny Mack Brown, John Wayne and the Three Musketeers. I watched serials, old serials from the 30s that were on TV when I was like 6 years old, 7 years old, 8 years old. Flash Gordon. Flash Gordon was a big influence on me.
Yeah, how so?
Well, it was futuristic. It had all kinds of interesting characters like the clay people, people who would be part of a rock cave, but then they would manifest themselves into more humanoid form. It was the precursor to Star Wars in many ways.
Well, it certainly laid the groundwork for what your career would become, which is vastly futuristic, science, fiction, action, horror, all of that.
Yes, I've always been into that. I've always been into the fantastique.
Was there a specific moment you decided I need to work in this field?
I graduated high school in 1966. I had made a lot of little movies in 8mm with my little trusty hand crank camera. They were just fun little independent movies for me. I did stop motion, trick effects things. So I had the filmmaking bug, but I didn't know how I would utilize it. So I went to college, liberal arts college, University of Wisconsin, where there was a lot of opportunity to get involved in anything that sounded interesting, extracurricular activities and in terms of studies. University of Wisconsin in 1966 through 1970, which is when I was there. One thing that was going on there, of course, was a new consciousness of political involvement. Vietnam was happening. We had social political movements. We had Black Power. We had Black Power consciousness. We had the beginnings of women's liberation. We had a lot of cutting edge things going on. And it was a great laboratory interacting with other students who were thinking outside of the box and trying to make a better world, striving for a better world. Meanwhile, the music was changing. The music was taking us on a trip. Cinema was advancing. Now, I love movies. So University of Wisconsin had a lot of movies, a lot of film societies, had a daily newspaper where there were film reviews. I decided I wanted to become a film critic because I had things to say about films. At the same time, I got involved with the Union Film Committee. Student Union had two movie theaters. So we brought a lot of filmmakers to campus, but we ran a lot of films. I would write film reviews about the films that we were programming. One of my agendas was to try to get as many obscure films shown in our theater that would turn people on, that they would never, films that they would never have heard about or seen if we hadn't brought them to Madison. And it was, you know, this was concurrent with the Nouvelle Vague, the New Wave cinema out of France, Godard's Breathless, out-of-the-box filmmaking techniques that challenge the traditional way of making movies. I mean, I love traditional and classical filmmaking. I also love the New Wave and the New British cinema, kitchen sink realism, Richard Lester, Tony Richardson. And we programmed all of this stuff, cutting-edge stuff. And I discovered, because I was reading a lot of film magazines all the time, and Sight and Sound magazine was the magazine that I read regularly out of the UK. And they always had an ad for a place called the London Film School. London Film School was a trade school. It was kind of unique because they really taught you the nuts and bolts of filmmaking, but not in an academic setting. It was more about a training ground for actual hands-on work. And the teachers there were all professional filmmakers. I finally decided to take my savings and try to get into the film school. I didn't write away to get in. I just decided to get a cheap plane ticket to London, student flight, and I was determined to get into the school. And I figured the way to do it was to go right up there and walk in the door, which I did. And I was instructed to make a photographic collage of storytelling, which I did.
As an audition. Entrance piece, yeah.
And they accepted me. And it was really quite amazing. It was very cheap. The tuition was $1,000 a year.
Did you declare, I want to go down editing, or how did you come into that as opposed to directing?
It was multifaceted. I took my classes. One of our course instructors was Mike Lee.
Oh, wow.
Who's a very well-known director today. Sure. Other directors were directors whom I had admired. British editors, Val Guest, who had made the Quatermass Experiment, Quatermass 2, two science fiction films that I consider classics. Wolf Rilla, who directed Village of the Damned. Clive Donner, who did What's New Pussycat. These were people, all of whom I work I respected, and they're teaching me. Something else happened while I was there. I used to spend time at the British Film Institute. British Film Institute is a government-sponsored organization. It's a charity, but they run archives. They run the National Film Theater. They have the British Film Institute Archive, BFI. They had an education department, which was mostly young film writers. Again, I just walked in off the street, but I kind of ingratiated myself with what was called the education department of the BFI. And what these people did was they would program films all throughout the week for study purposes. You name it, Hitchcock, Hawks, Ford, Rossellini, Douglas Sirk. My knowledge of cinema became much, much more profound. And in fact, I discovered a new respect for the American cinema because I was now looking at American cinema through the eyes of the English who highly respected American cinema. You know, when I was in college, I knew American cinema had a solid ground, but I always thought, but a lot of it's Hollywood, it's the Dream Factory. And I was saying, you know, my champions were Fellini and Bergman and Antonioni. But then I discovered the American cinema was great because it had all of these people from all different nationalities, all different cultural backgrounds, who came and emigrated to America and influenced the American movie-making system in a way that techniques from all of the foreign cinemas were transmutated into the evolution of the American cinema. So the new American cinema, which happened in the 60s, Bonnie and Clyde, The Wild Bunch, we had a great revolution in American cinema as well.
Well, Corman was part of that revolution.
Oh, yeah.
Major. So at what point did you come back and get into that amazing family of New World and working with Corman?
Well, in 1974, I had been working and doing a little teaching at the London Film School. At the same time, I had a feeling that I wanted to get back to my American roots and I could go to Hollywood. You know, like so many wide-eyed, bushy-tailed young people, I think you can relate to this, Jeremy. Hollywood, here I come. Here I am. I'm here. So that's what happened. I spent my first night in a Holiday Inn. By the second night, I had found some old friends who had a spare couch, and I became a crasher, crashing around in different people's houses. And one day, I went to a movie, one of Roger Corman's movies, called Death Race 2000, directed by Paul Bartel. And Death Race 2000 rocked my world, because it was made with such energy, such obvious delight in filmmaking, with meager resources, that I said to myself, Roger Corman makes movies. I'm going to get a job at Roger Corman's. So I walked in off the street. This is a recurring theme. I basically walk into a place off the street, and here I am. And I walked into this place, New World Pictures, on Sunset Boulevard, said to the young woman at the desk, who do I talk to about getting a job in editing? So I skipped the part where I should have told you that I found in London Film School that editing was something that I really loved and that I had a natural ability with. So I became very enamored of editing, and editing was what I wanted to get into, and also as a means to getting to direct. So anyway, who do I talk to about getting a job here at New World Pictures? She said, talk to that guy over there, whose name was John Davison, who was a great guy. At that point, he was head of advertising for New World Pictures, and he was about to produce his first movie, very low budget, $60,000 budget, 10-day shoot, Hollywood Boulevard, directed by Joe Dante and Alan Arkush. Two directors, no waiting. Two crews working simultaneously. At the end of our meeting, during the meeting, I learned that John was an incredible film buff, like I was. He collected films. He had a particular fondness for the fantastique, horror films, gothic, mysteries, Charlie Chan movies. Everything that I liked, he liked. So he offered me a job for no pay. I took it.
Editing?
No, it was bringing coffee and donuts to the set.
Perfect.
It was sweeping out latrines. It was tearing down old sets.
So basically what interns do today.
Yeah, I was a PA. I was a PA.
Yeah.
For no pay. And we worked 18-hour days. You know, after about 4 days into the film or something, I said, John, I got to get some money here. I really have to eat and pay my rent. And so he got me $60 a week. And then the next time they wanted me to be a PA, I got $150 a week. John Davison was trying to get me into the editing room. I finally got my way into an assistant editing job on some American short stories, it was called. Meanwhile, Joe Dante and Alan Arkush were continuing to direct movies, and Joe got a movie at New World called Piranha, and he asked me if I would co-edit it with him. A very low budget for its time picture.
What was your collaboration with him like in the editing room?
Well, you know, he was shooting the picture, and a lot of it was on location in Texas. I stayed home in L.A. I got the footage in. I looked at the dailies. I'd be the first one to see them. I would call him intermittently and tell him what I thought of them. Like, I think you need a close-up of this. You need more blood in the water for when these people are dying underwater. Stuff like that.
But yeah.
He did a tremendous job on it. He had a great cast. A Piranha went on. It made money, and it was a legitimate picture that people knew about. And it helped my career because people who were into that kind of movie respected the movie. Piranha is actually a really well-made movie. It's even got subtext to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's passionate because Joe is a genre fan. There's a person who's totally involved in what he's making and makes it his own and is respectful of the genre, doesn't look down on it, is enamored of it, and takes control of it and works in the medium.
So let's talk about collaboration a little bit. You've worked with many fantastic directors, but on repeat, Michael Bay, James Cameron, Joe Dante, Paul Verhoeven. Are there similarities between them? They're more than just directors. They're incredible visionaries. So what do they share?
The
How are they different?
You've mentioned do share that in common, that they are singular in their worldviews, their artistic views, their methodology of storytelling, and they make an imprint, a personal imprint on the work that they do, which is great. Those are the kinds of people I like to work for. People who really have a voice, who have a vision, and fight for the vision and keep it alive, and people who stimulate me.
How did you meet James Cameron?
Well, I actually kind of knew James Cameron without really knowing him. I think I might have been introduced to him once or twice when he was working on Battle Beyond the Stars, which was a Roger Corman production, and they were working in Venice, California. And he was doing kinds of art direction and working on a few other pictures for Roger, Forbidden World, helping out with the set designs and visual things. Gail Hurd, who produced The Terminator, had been Roger Corman's personal assistant for a while. I knew Gail from when she first came to work at New World Pictures. We kind of liked each other right away. And she was involved in Humanoids from the Deep, which is a picture that I did that needed a lot of work in the editing to make work. So she was producing The Terminator. She thought that I would be a good fit to work with Jim, and she recommended me to Jim Cameron. So I met with Jim for lunch, and we discovered that we had a lot of likes that we shared. We were both very impressed by George Miller's Mad Max and Road Warrior 2, Mad Max 2.
I mean, I had not seen Terminator since I was a teenager, and going back, watching both of them, the thing that stuck out to me so much was the pacing of Terminator 1 is just incredible. It's like one long chase scene mm-hmm. from beginning to end, and the tension of that is throughout the whole movie. It's really a crazy ride to be on.
Well, I feel that the tension, trying to maintain attention, is very important in the movie because, in fact, that's the crux of the movie is about can Sarah Connor survive where the Terminator is getting closer to her all the time. He's unstoppable.
Yeah.
He will not stop ever until you are dead, says Kyle Reese. And that's incessant. There is no rest. It's interesting, though. I think editorially, I mean, I was very influenced by my New World Picture days, where you really cut to the bone. And I did cut it pretty tight.
Were you editing very fast on that picture?
Pretty fast. I cut it on Moviolas. It took me about 6 to 8 weeks to get the picture done after wrap. But I think after my first cut, there wasn't a lot of work. You know, I would work with Jim on the weekends, so when he wanted certain changes and things, I implemented them.
Would you say you prefer to edit collaboratively with a director sort of over your shoulder with you, or do you like to just put a cut together, present it, get notes, work on it?
I like to be given the opportunity to give my own take on it the first time, because I feel that's really the greatest value that I have to offer, is pure objectivity to a director. That's why you hire somebody else to edit your movie. If you edit your movie, you've got your point of view, but it's actually more difficult for the filmmaker who created the mise-en-scene to begin with to get outside of the desired intention in the first place. But the fact is that there may be all kinds of different ways to reinterpret what was shot. Better ways, possibly. Who can say? I'm not saying my way is better. When I'm directing, I directed a couple of pictures, and I always hire an editor to work with. And I made it clear I reserved the right to come in and do some editing myself, because I figure I'm a good editor. And what I know, one thing I know about editing is, to edit a movie, you actually have to roll up your sleeves and edit the movie. You can't be sitting in the room saying, try that, try that, try that, try that, try that. That's not really editing. To the nth degree, you've got to get your hands dirty. You've got to get in the mix, and you've got to play with the material.
And how do you handle situations if a director has a different point of view than you?
The editor should be an extension of the director in a way. Even though I may come up with ideas that the director never thought of, they may come up with ideas that I never thought of. It's a collaboration.
Can you give an example of maybe a bold point of view that you had as an editor that a director was hesitant to explore at first, but you wound up winning out?
Well, I don't know how bold it was. On the first Terminator, we had one scene in particular that I lobbied to delete from the movie. And it's when Kyle Reese, who was the good guy from the future, who comes to save Sarah Connor from the clutches of the Terminator.
Right.
When he's in a culvert, she treats his wounds.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a stop in the action. They have a moment of respite.
Oh, right, in the tunnel. Run. Sure.
There's a scene that came after that scene the next morning where they're going through a small little garden. Not a garden, a little woodsy area. Kyle is reminiscing about how he never saw beautiful things growing in daylight. You know, his future world was dark and grim and cold and wet, and he breaks down in tears. And I thought, I mean, I'm not afraid of emotion, but I just felt you didn't need that. We stopped the action long enough. And Jim finally, you know, he wrote it and directed it. So he liked it, but he finally came around to my way of thinking.
Did you have any sense while you were editing Terminator what kind of a classic this was going to become?
Well, no. I knew it was a very good movie. I knew I was excited to be doing it, because I was. You make a movie, you have no idea what's going to happen to that movie. You don't know if people are going to like it, if people are going to dislike it, if people are going to come to buy tickets, or if people are going to stay home and ignore it. You just don't know. We knew we had a good picture. And even when it opened, it got some really good reviews. It did pretty well. But there were still people who didn't like it. But it kind of stayed around. It got into people's consciousness, and people went back to see it again. And it became ultimately a household word, like Frankenstein. Whoever thinks that your film is going to become a household word, an icon, I'll be back.
I'll be back. What's funny is I didn't realize he only says that once.
Yeah.
And that was such a legendary line. He only says it once in both films.
It's amazing.
Hasta la vista, baby.
Yeah.
I think he says.
And you know what? I cut both of those scenes.
Did you?
Yes. So I was the first person to actually see in context Arnold Schwarzenegger saying, I'll be back.
I'd love to talk about your directing. So after, obviously, you have worked on a number of films, but roughly 1987.
87.
Dead Heat. Was it difficult to convince people that you wanted to direct, or was it offered to you?
Well, you have to work at these things. You can't just wait for someone to offer you stuff. That's not likely to happen. What happened was, I got a call from a producer friend of mine, John Davison, who I mentioned earlier in this podcast. Anyway, he was producing a picture called RoboCop, and Paul Verhoeven was directing it. Now, I had met Paul through John earlier, and we hit it off. Anyway, they needed some second unit material shot.
On RoboCop.
On RoboCop. And could I come down to, I think it was in Dallas, if I recall. Could I come to location and work with them? I got to work closely with Paul and get his concept of what he needed and get storyboards drawn up so that I could get them. And then Paul said, once you do the shots I need, you can shoot anything you want.
And so after you had proven yourself multiple times, it sounds like, editing, doing second unit directing, now this with RoboCop, Dead Heat was...
Dead Heat was a project that I heard about, so I threw my hat in the ring, now that I had an agent who could help to throw hats.
What was it about the movie you liked so much, the script?
Well, I liked the combination of comedy and horror film.
Was anyone attached already? Was Vincent Price...
No, nobody was attached. It was, we'll get it made if we get the proper actors or stars. So we had to find actors who were willing to do this kind of a picture, who had some cred, street cred, as you will.
Mm-hmm.
And we finally found Tree Williams, who was great, and Joe Piscopo, and we wound up with a new comedy team.
I know you're such a horror fan. What is it like to work with Vincent Price?
It was amazing. First of all, he's completely down to earth, has no ego trip going on at all. He's there to do his very best. He's committed to the project. He's totally prepared and totally professional. And he's Vincent Price.
Yeah.
I mean, I would be talking to him about all these old movies that I had seen that he was in. I was a big fan of his with the William Castle pictures. His Kind of Woman, which is a John Farrow picture with Robert Mitchum. He plays a ham Shakespearean actor who becomes like one of the heroes in the picture. And it turned out we were shooting a scene for Dead Heat in the same shooting studio that he had shot parts of that film on.
What was the most surprising thing you took away from that experience as a director?
Well, I mean, it was more work than I had ever imagined. I was so into it on the first day. For one thing, I couldn't sleep the night before my first shooting day, because I was just so nervous. And I was working with Vincent Price that day. By the time we got to noontime, and I was trying to take care of Vincent and work with the camera people and get everything going, and I was just putting out so much energy with no sleep that I think I was, I thought I was going to get a heart attack, literally. And I had to, like, excuse myself for a few minutes just to recompose. Luckily, I didn't have a heart attack, and I got through the first day. And Vincent was great. That's the surprising thing. When your actors are on target and doing the work and doing it well, you can relax because they're making the film. They're embodying the text. And it's a warm, fuzzy feeling. And it was amazing to be working with them creatively. And I always try to give them a lot of space, you know, not try to impose things. But try to guide them and try to be a mirror for them if they're too broad or not broad enough, big enough, small enough, whatever. And just try to give them honest feedback.
Was any of your anxiety about the fact that as an editor, you have the pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the pieces. You're putting the puzzle together. And as a director, you're picking the pieces. It's open range for the most part. Was that overwhelming for you, or you felt
not
like
overwhelming? But I did feel the need for coverage because I didn't trust myself. And you know, one thing you know as an editor is that coverage can save you.
Do you have any advice for people in the industry that want to pivot and transition from editing to directing or acting to writing? Or
just do it. Get a camera and do it. Easy to do that these days.
Yeah.
Do it on any scale that you can. Just tell stories.
Did anything change in your editing process after you directed Punisher and Dead Heat?
That's a great question. I don't know that it did. You know, I was always an editor. For example, on the two films that I directed, I edited sections of them and certain key scenes. And I did it because I was available. I was free. So why shouldn't I exploit myself? And I had an understanding with the editors that I hired that I would do that. take the opportunity to edit my choice of scenes or to re-edit, which isn't to say I disrespected the editors that I worked with. I respected them highly, and they were very valuable because they gave me input that I would not have had otherwise. And, you know, when my two feature films didn't do so well at the box office, my career kind of, as the director, kind of waned. And I was still offered stuff, but I was offered stuff that I just literally didn't want to do. So I went back into editing because I could get a higher level of picture.
Do you have a set of criteria when you sign on to a movie you're looking to edit?
Criteria?
Yeah, anything important that stands out?
Well, I guess the most important rule is don't take the job if it's a movie that you wouldn't go to see if I hadn't worked on it. In other words, make sure it's a project that you can get behind emotionally, politically, spiritually. I mean, if it's filled with mayhem, I don't mind that because it's dark pulp fiction entertainment is also okay because it's all fantasy. But make sure it's aligned at the end of the day. Make sure it does no harm.
Make sure that beneath whatever the fantasy element of it is, that the message is somehow redeeming, or...
I say that, and of course I've done a number of pictures that may be on the edge
right.
of that.
Well, speaking of a film that has become a cult classic in a lot of ways, do you think people misunderstood Showgirls when it came out?
Well, it's a complicated film. In a way, it's a bigger than life, first of all, almost Fellini-esque, but it's Verhoeven-esque. Paul Verhoeven has a vision of the world, and it's very specific to his art. And it's bigger than life in some cases. And he set out to make a movie that really is about a certain subculture or a certain subculture that existed back when the movie was made. It's about power plays in the hierarchy of the work environment. It's about subjugation of women and exploitation of women, but it's told in a brutal fashion. There's brutality in it. There's mean-spiritedness in it. There's exploitation in it. There's redemption. It's a political statement, and it's very transgressive. There's a stylization involved. It's a version of reality that's other than your reality. It found its audience. I mean, a lot of people really like it these
days. Oh, yeah.
It's unfortunate that it didn't find its audience back then. But again, and I'll say this about American culture, sex is always problematic. It's like everybody loves it, sex, that is, but they don't want to admit that they love it the way they love it. So there's this guilt about watching it. And here comes a mainstream picture in a mainstream cinema release that puts sex on the front burner. And it's easier to ridicule that than to confront it. But Showgirls is a reaction to the American sensibility and sense of reality of sex, in a way. Or one part of it, very specifically in Las Vegas and the exploitation of sex. And that's a piece of art, period. But it's not for everybody. I will grant you that.
Another one of his films, though, that is obviously very different as Starship Troopers. Were you involved in that as you were with some other films from the beginning, with sort of picking the shots and assisting with the storyboarding?
Yes. Paul's very collaborative and wants to keep all his creative co-partners close to him. It was a long shoot, and the visual effects were another year.
The effects in that are incredible, especially for that time.
Well, Phil Tippett is one of the great masters of animation cinema. But still, the visual effects turnover was very tight. We had a deal with Sony Imageworks, who were doing the spaceships, a lot of the outer space stuff. ILM also did some. But the deal with Sony Imageworks was that we would supply to them a locked cut of every scene that was affected by visual effects 3 days after the completion of photography of that scene.
Wow.
Now, this had to start while we were shooting the picture. So in addition to cutting the day's work from the previous day and keeping up the camera so we could assess what we had to lock the visual effects sequence down. And Paul's on the set most of the time and not near the editing room necessarily. So what we did was Phil Tippett would be on the set when they were shooting the effects stuff. And then I would get to the effects and I'd get Phil into the editing room with me so we could go over the material together so that he could be part of the process of selecting the takes and so that I could be privy to his thoughts about how to maximize the potential of the shots as they're cut together.
Is that common?
Well, not really, because it's logistically sometimes impossible.
Right.
And sometimes the filmmakers, like the director and the editor, want to keep close rein on the thing and maybe don't want the input from the visual effects house. They want to give the input to the visual effects house. Sometimes. And it's like an ego thing. What I am saying is Phil Tippett was crucial to the making of Starship Troopers. He designed the bugs. He was the godfather of the bugs. He was the god creator of the bugs.
He was that the bug that thinks, the big slug.
Yes, the brain bug.
Brain bug, yeah.
Brain bugs?
Can you give me an example of a particularly difficult scene from one of your films and what the problem was and how you overcame it?
Well, I'd have to think about that. There are occasions when I can't figure out how to cut something. If that's the case, I put that scene on the shelf and move on to the next scene. Sure, there may be technical issues, there may be performance issues. It may be my own mental block. Sometimes it just doesn't flow. I found that when I put it aside and don't hassle it, don't overthink it, and come back to it fresh, that I usually come up with a new perspective. So clearing your mind, that's why meditation is good for editors. I won't go into a whole rap about it, but I'll say it's very good for living and operating in the world and the universe. And it's very good for editors and for filmmakers, for directors.
When you get that material, you're obviously looking at the script also.
Yes.
Are there initial goals that you have when you set out? In other words, are you just like, okay, literally, let's put the scene together word by word? And then are you constantly going through it, trying to assess the subtext? Why are we really watching the scene? What is underneath it? Or do you just let that blossom from the editing?
Both. You could take an overriding view of the whole piece and try to distill it down to themes, theses, underlying text and subtext. But the script is a prototype. When the script is shot and realized by a director, and you get different angles and different takes and different performances, you're now rebuilding something. And you can't rebuild it from the instructions on a page. The script can only be your guide because you have a new reality. And that new reality is informed by directorial decisions, by lighting, by performance, and takes you to a new place. That's art. That's the creation. It takes you to a new place, and you have to go with it. And as an editor, you have to go with it and shepherd it. And you have to become one with it and build it.
Is that what's the most rewarding aspect of editing for you?
That's the spiritual aspect of it. To me, it's almost a religious experience because you become one with the project. If you take it seriously, and I'm serious now, I do that. But you don't have to think too hard about it. The thing is not to think about it. Your thoughts are going to happen whether you're thinking or you think you're thinking, but you can let the thoughts just float by. Respond to the footage. An editor is a responder to the footage and a reconceiver. You have to absorb it through studying it, and then you let your gut interact with the film to find the film, to find the through line. Beginning, middle, end, it's all connected. Trajectory of performance, trajectory of dramatic intensity, pure storytelling, it's all there. So the best editing I've ever done is when I'm not thinking about it. Is when I'm going through the motions of selecting, looking at things, studying things. That's a great line. That's a great look. That's a great performance. Oh, he couldn't remember his dialogue there. Have to cut around it. What is the pace? What is the subtext of the scene? Oh, yes. And you just do it. It's a process. You're doing it. You're not thinking it.
If you are blocked, you talked about putting it to the side, letting it marinate in your subconscious.
Right.
Do you have other go-to mechanisms that you use? Like, will you throw in a song, any song or something, just to see if there's a different vibe or...
Yes. We work with music a lot because music elevates mood, puts you in a particular place.
Even if you're not thinking about that particular song for the scene, but just to inform something that you're doing.
Practically, you're going to want to show the scenes with music to begin with and rudimentary sound effects because you're selling the reality of the cut. And therefore, there should be no distractions, audio or visually. It should feel like a movie. However, my relationship with music is that part of editing is a musical process as well. And the rhythms are in the undercurrent of the montage, the collection of shots and the relationship of the shots to the next shots and so on and so forth. And I find that, especially when I was cutting on film on Emilio Viola, where it was really a physical kind of cutting, where you'd have to be throwing pieces of film on and looking at frames and cutting them and knowing when to cut and when not to cut. I would always cut without music, unless music was the primary motivation for the scene. If there's a playback to a song and it's a given song, that's one thing. But the reason I would stay away from music until I got my cut done is that I feel that in a sense I'm composing the music in a rhythmic way. And I don't need to have a piece of music external to the movie controlling the impact of the images and sound that I'm working with. And sometimes I would cut a scene and be humming, making up my own music.
And they used that exact track in Piranha, didn't they?
Well, sometimes it's uncannily close. And I would have a lot of different temp music available on any given film. Try to get music that you think would work for the various scenes in the story. And when it works really well. It's amazing sometimes. We used to have a thing where I would just take a piece of music, throw it in just randomly and play it against the scene, and it's perfect. All the beats are there, the emotion changing. We used to call it miracle sync. It's like the universe cut the music.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the movie.
How do you make chemistry between actors if there isn't any?
Tough question. Well, it's impossible in a two-shot. Actually, not. Maybe not. Because today, in digital editing, you can cut a two-shot into pieces. So you can have one person on the left from one take and another person on the right from another take and meld them together if the camera's locked down. And even if it isn't locked down, you could do it. So there's a lot of little tricks you can do now, and we've been doing them for years. An actor has long pauses. An actor sticks his tongue out between lines of dialogue. I once had one actor who would say, blah, 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 blah.
Licking his lips.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he was on coke or something. So you had to cut around the lips, cut around the tongue, cut around the pause.
Cut around the tongue by Mark Goldblatt.
Chemistry is tough. Chemistry is where the camera catches the soul of the actors, really. And the actors are capturing each other's soul in terms of their relationship on screen. And that is undeniable. You can't inject that in. You can't digitally put pathos into a performance. You can change the mechanics of it. You can take a better performance than may exist in a two-shot with a better performance on the other actor, and kind of meld them together and kludge them together so that you can do that. And sometimes you have magic.
But that's a tall order.
It's a tall order. It's like if the movie is not working, if the mise-en-scene is bad, if the casting is wrong, if the chemistry is wrong and off, then generally speaking, you can make the picture shorter or longer. You can take the ending and put it in the beginning to have flashbacks. You can do all kinds of tricks, but it may only be sugarcoating. And the essence may still be flat.
Mm.
It's a fragile thing. There are no rules, but you know when it's real.
Yeah.
And you know when it's bullshit.
In your acceptance speech for career achievement from America Cinema Editors,
mm-hmm.
You mentioned that boldness was so important to you and in your work. You were saying that to young editors, I guess. Can you elaborate on what you mean by that?
The editing process is a very malleable process. You can shift and change things. I think if you seriously make a commitment to being a good storyteller, it's not a job that you just do by rote. The best people in this trade are people who love what they do, who have to make the film better, who have a need to make the film better, and who are committed to making the film better. Because when you opt for a job, see, this is why it's such a delightful thing to do, in a way. If you get on a movie of a subject matter that you like, it's like, wow, what, that script is really cool. And if you're lucky enough to work with a great director and or producer or both, somebody who's got a vision, somebody who wants to make the best film ever, and we're going to make the best film ever, and let's go, let's do it. But that means total 100% commitment, 24/7. That means be there. That means take it beyond what you think you need to do. In other words, it's not a 9-to-5 job. Quitting time, going home now. I mean, I'm talking about people who commit. I'm talking about you're living with this film 24/7. You've made it your own. It's your life's journey to make this picture great, whatever it is.
Yeah, I would say that level of commitment is the bare minimum of what's required just to even have a career in this business, to take it even farther, to really
not everybody does it.
Well, sure.
Some people who are real talented don't do it. It's almost a sacred craft, the making of a piece of work, whether it be a piece of theater or a film or a song. You're in the universe and you're creating something new that will touch other people. You're communicating, you're entertaining, you're enlightening, you're taking an idea and running with it. And then you're allowing the input of the universe to correspond with your intentions. Forget about intentions. It's coming right from your channeling. You're channeling some greater power than yourself. That's what it is.
And so how would you advise a young up-and-coming editor to do that, to find that channeling?
Well, take your work seriously and do it for yourself and do it for the love of cinema, which is the love of your fellow person, which is the love of God, because you're putting stuff out into the world and you're sharing it with everybody. It's a sacred trust, as is your interrelationship with your peers that you're working with is a sacred trust. When I work on a film and I'm really involved in it, it's someone other than me is doing it. It's something else. And that's when I know that it's working. And it's tremendously enlightening, and it makes me feel good. And I think that comes through in the work. I think you see a really great picture and you can feel it. You can feel the emotion. And you can feel that you're in a room with 1,000 people watching that movie. But, you know, you can feel it. You ever go to a movie where you feel the emotion?
Oh, absolutely.
It's like an ocean of emotion.
That's why we need movies to play in theaters.
Absolutely.
We need the community. We need to share those molecules in the room. It's essential. It's how it's designed.
That's right. That's right. And for those of us who were involved in the making of a film, it's a blessing.
Is there any piece of advice that you've gotten that's stuck with you throughout your whole career?
Always think of the film. Protecting the film is your number one responsibility. That's your job. Sometimes it could get you fired, but protect the film. Protect the filmmakers. Protect the actors. Do good works.
I think that's a great way to end. Thank you so much for doing this, Mark.
My pleasure.
I don't know about you, but I just love the way that conversation ends. Protect the film. I just love that. Anyhow, thank you everyone for giving us a listen. And for those of you who have taken a moment to like, rate, and subscribe to our podcast, thank you. You're the best. And for those of you who had not had a chance, please do so and spread the word about us. Follow us at Movie Mentors Podcast on Instagram and on our Facebook page, where you can see more content and behind-the-scenes goodies. I'd like to thank Chris Battaglia for his help with this episode, as well as Gabe Sokoloff for the music. Thanks so much, everyone. Be well and keep making movies!